From Cherokee to Currituck, from the largest city to the smallest town, and from the state house to the schoolhouse, it's Carolina Journal Radio, your weekly news magazine discussing North Carolina's most important public policy events and issues.
Welcome to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. During the next hour, Donna Martinez and I will explore some major issues affecting our state. A proposed federal border adjustment tax is drawing fire from retail merchants and from consumer advocates in North Carolina. You'll learn why. The sad death of a Moore County toddler back in 2015 has led the North Carolina General Assembly to enact what's called Ryland's Law. You'll learn how the measure targets child abuse. President Trump is still developing his foreign policy, but one expert from the Reagan era already sees signs of a potentially successful grand strategy. You'll learn why. He discussed it recently in Raleigh. And we'll learn why legislative staffers missed the mark with a recent projection of a $1 billion state budget hole. Those topics are just ahead. First, Donna Martinez joins us with the Carolina Journal headline.
It is a top 10 list that you do not want to be on, but North Carolina is among the top 10 states for human trafficking. In 2016 alone, 181 cases were reported, and now state lawmakers are taking notice of this human tragedy. Rick Henderson is the editor-in-chief of Carolina Journal. This issue is now the cover story of the July issue of the print edition. Rick, welcome back to the program.
Thank you, Donna.
It's an amazing series, and I would just encourage people, if they haven't seen the print edition, the July edition of Carolina Journal, that they either get their hands on one through us or to go online and read these stories. What is human trafficking, Rick?
Human trafficking is essentially a process in which people are taken often against their will. We're going to separate the two kinds of human trafficking in a moment, but taken against their will and forced to do essentially taken hostage and forced to perform certain actions in exchange for their freedom and safety, or exchange for their safety, not only their freedom, but their safety. Now, there are two distinct types of human trafficking that we're aware of. Most people think of what's known as labor trafficking, and that is the worker who can't get into the country legally as an immigrant, paying a mule in some other country to pile in a van and drive to some place and then obtain false documents to work in the United States. That's the sort of thing you hear about, because you hear about the van that overturns on a highway and 10 people are killed or 20 people are killed, and that they each paid like $2,000 to get the false documentation. That's gotten the most attention until recently. But what this what these stories by Kerry Travis feature are the sex trade, and that is sometimes the abduction of people who are not in the country legally. More often, so it seems, the abduction of people who are in bad home situations, who can't make a living otherwise, who may already be prostitutes or who may be working in strip clubs or something like that, and being marketed against their will, once again, and being forced to live in this situation of servitude, if you will. And the awareness that we're gaining of this issue and the difficulties not only in finding people who are involved and trying to rescue them, but also if they're removed from sex trafficking, if they're out of this network, then what happens to them at that point? Then what can they do?
Rick, a key component of this is fear. Mm-hmm. Because they are trapped, not necessarily kidnapped and, for example, chained to a wall or something, but they have a fear that has been instilled in them that if you leave or if you stop doing this, something very bad is going to happen to you.
Right, exactly. The fear, or if you attempt to get away, if you attempt to contact family members or other people who may have known you before you were trafficked, before you were abducted essentially into this trade, that you're going to die, you're going to be badly injured, something may happen to your family members. I mean, you hear situations, again, of people, let's say in another situation of people who are in this country legally, who have family members in other countries that are essentially being held hostage for payments coming across the border and things like that. So, I mean, it's a situation that we didn't think happened in this country very much. We thought it was sort of something that happened elsewhere. But it's now a situation that is becoming more and more apparent in the United States.
Obviously, a human tragedy, and that's part of the headline of this series in the July edition of Carolina Journal. But, Rick, this has now become a public policy issue. Mm-hmm. Obviously, it is a law enforcement issue for things that are happening that are illegal. But why is the state legislature interested in this?
The state legislature is getting interested in it because, for one thing, as law enforcement is dealing with this issue, this is not just your basic prostitution ring typically you're dealing with. This is a situation in which you have women who are being sometimes abducted or recruited from places like strip clubs, massage parlors, and are being brought into captivity. And then when law enforcement, they may be able to bust up a ring, but at the point of that the women are either released from the criminal justice system or simply just allowed to go, then you have all the sorts of issues that they have dealt with during their time in captivity. They have all sorts of issues of Stockholm syndrome or other different types of mental and emotional distress. They have very, very few legitimately marketable job skills, quite possibly. They may, if they're in the case of some instances, they may not speak English very well. They may not have other contacts in this country even. And so it becomes a issue of social welfare organizations, both private and public, and how is it possible to help these women heal, and it's mostly women, help these women heal, and then also reintegrate them into society.
Rick, are there nonprofits who are doing work specifically to help this type of victim?
We mentioned one in particular in this in these stories, Redeeming Joy, which is the story, and it's the story of Joy Anderson and also of the woman who rescued her. And this is an organization based in Charlotte. There are some, they are not very well publicized, and some of that's for obvious reasons, because you don't want to let the people who are involved in organizing these organized crime rings know where the victims are. Secondly, there are not an awful lot of organizations that are really equipped to handle this. There are various religious organizations, churches, and the like. The Salvation Army is now trying to get involved in this, but their role essentially is to, with the Salvation Army, is to help homeless people who otherwise probably have pretty good coping skills get them into society. But quite often, women who have been involved in trafficking, especially some from very early ages, don't have those coping skills. They've always been dependent on their pimp, or they have been addicted to drugs throughout. They've been malnourished quite often. I mean, they're not in any sort of position necessarily to be able simply to have, you know, a warm bed and a few meals and some spiritual guidance and then go out in the world. And so this is something that's really going to cause a demand for an awful lot of additional services. And so that's another reason why the legislature is involved, but it's why organizations like the Salvation Army are getting interested, but they're still trying to sort of grope around with how you exactly you deal with this and how you help these women.
Now, as you and I are talking, there is a bill that has been passed by the General Assembly, and at this point in time, it is on Governor Cooper's desk. Don't know exactly how he will deal with it. Senate 548, what's in it?
It's a bill that was championed by Lieutenant Governor Dan Forrest, and the main purpose of the bill was informational as much as anything else. The design for the bill was to make sure that people who were going to basic businesses where trafficking may take place were aware that trafficking was going on. Maybe not necessarily there, but to let them know that there was actually a hotline that people could call if they were aware of trafficking or if they're victims of trafficking. So this would apply not only to places like strip clubs, but also to a very controversial thing, massage and body work locations. And the massage industry was very, very the spa industry was very, very defensive about this issue. But they part of the discussion was that in an awful lot of body therapy places that may not be in the highest rent part of town, The women who often work there are independent contractors who just rent a space for a while. And so this was to let maybe them know that if they're essentially being doing this against their will, that there's a way that they might be able to find some help.
I think also in that bill, there's some stiffer criminal penalties for those who are engaging in prostitution.
That's correct. That's right. And there was
the pimps, so to speak.
That's right.
I hate to use that word on the radio, but that's what they're called.
That's correct. There were those. The other concern, though, was that now that this bill has passed, some of the people who were involved in trying to help these women are saying, well, now that we've increased awareness, now what happens? Now we're getting more calls, and how do we now help these women that now that we know more about them?
We've been talking with the editor-in-chief, Rick Henderson. Thank you, Rick.
Thank you.
Stay with us. Much more Carolina Journal Radio to come in just a moment.
Government plays a key role in your life, affecting your paycheck, the way you educate your kids, the way you do business. How can you tell if government is doing a good job, making the right choices, spending tax dollars wisely? CarolinaJournal.com tackles those questions every day. The John Locke Foundation publishes Carolina Journal in print each month and on the web each day at CarolinaJournal.com. You'll find exclusive investigative reports on topics no one else is covering. What else? A rundown of the best news stories, editorials, and opinion columns in North Carolina. John Hood's Daily Journal. News stories and important public events at CarolinaJournal.tv. And the voices of the newsmakers themselves at Carolina Journal Radio. In print, on the air, and on the web, you can find the information you need at CarolinaJournal.com. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. As Congress debates federal tax reform, one controversial idea has attracted a lot of attention. It's called the Border Adjustment Tax, or BAT. Retailers and consumer advocates in North Carolina have been speaking out against the BAT. Joining us to explain why is Andy Ellen, President and General Counsel of the North Carolina Retail Merchants Association. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me today.
Before we talk about why you think BAT is bad, when we're talking about a border adjustment tax, what are we talking about?
Well, let me say, misnomer one, it's not about building a wall, as some folks have thought about with the border. It is a proposal that has come from the House Ways and Means Chairman Kevin Brady and the House Speaker Paul Ryan as a way to offset tax reductions on the corporate side. And so in Congress, you have to have a pay-go, so you have to pay for something as you do other things. And so their idea is that anything that is exported would not be subject to tax. So it would not count as revenue if you export something and sell it into a foreign country. But if you import something, you would not get to write off the cost of those goods as you currently do today. So if you import a widget and you pay $10 for it currently, you get to write that off as a cost of goods. You would no longer be able to do that, which is essentially a 20% tax on those that import anything at all in the United States.
Some people are going to hear that and say, that sounds good for American-made goods because you wouldn't pay taxes on something you export, but those people who import, they have to pay taxes. Why is that a bad thing?
Well, I think we are now as a global economy, and there are many things, as I've said previously, that we have to get from outside the United States. And, you know, I think about what I had for breakfast this morning, which was a cup of coffee and a banana, and we don't grow either one of those in the United States. So every one of those would be essentially subject to a 20% tariff. You know, you think about other things. I know right now, for instance, the avocado market, which can be grown in California, they've had a very bad crop in the last few years in California because of rain and other things. So we'll be importing a lot of those this year for your Mexican food, and just got through Cinco de Mayo is another item. Or if you think about a car manufacturer, a car may be assembled here in the United States, but some of the parts may be manufactured elsewhere and brought into the United States for it to be assembled here. So everywhere you turn, there are parts or goods themselves that have to be imported into the United States.
In talking about the impact of this border adjustment tax, your group and other groups working on this issue have said this could have a major substantial impact on households across North Carolina.
Well, correct. Essentially, you're raising the cost of many goods by as much as 20%. And so that would add up to roughly $1,700 per family per year on average. So that's an additional $1,700 you'll be pulling out of your bank account. You know, if you think about something like the price of gas, most of our gasoline in this country comes from overseas. throw a, you know, immediate 20% increase on that. What the economists have done, folks like Art Laffler and others, very conservative economics professionals, have said is that it would cost approximately 42 million jobs potentially in the United States. Retailers would be hurt as much as anybody else. And that's bad for small towns. It's bad for your mall. It's bad for Main Street, because if those businesses close up because they're having to dramatically increase prices by up to 20%, that's more dark storefronts in our towns. That's less property tax. That's less employees. It's less payroll tax.
Now, you mentioned goods like your coffee and your bananas, but we're also talking about things that people buy, clothing, other types of appliances or equipment, anything that would come from another country, there'd be this extra tax on it.
Anything that comes from another country, and again, whether that's the item as a whole or whether it's a component of those items. And I've said previously, you know, I can't move the equator. You know, I can't help that we can't grow in the United States bananas or coffee, but those are items that are very popular here. My children like to eat strawberries year round, but we don't grow those in the United States in January. So any of those items are going to certainly be subject to that tax and increase, again, prices for everybody, every working family in America.
We're speaking with Andy Ellen. He is president and general counsel of the North Carolina Retail Merchants Association. I want to loop back to something you just mentioned, and that is component parts. So this has been sold, the border adjustment tax, as a way to help American-made products in the export market. Does it hurt those companies that have to import materials before they assemble their products that they want to then sell to other countries?
It certainly does, because, again, they would not be able to write off the cost of those goods. The way the corporate income tax works now is you have your total amount that you sold dollar-wise, and you get to subtract off as a deduction things like wages or rent or utilities and cost of goods to get a net profit that you then apply the tax to. And what the border adjustment tax essentially says is everything you export out doesn't count as a sale. So, but everything that you import, you don't get to write those costs of goods off. So for a component part, you would not get to write that off. Even if part of the component parts are from the United States and part are from overseas, you only get off to write off a portion of that and then sell it overseas. Again, it dramatically increases the cost of goods. There is this theory from Speaker Ryan and from Congressman Brady, who are more theoretical on this, that it will raise the value of the dollar by 25% if we do this. And I think that's more in a textbook than it is in an actual real world economics that you see on Main Street.
How worried are retail merchants about something like this?
I mean, I think from many retail merchants, and a lot of folks have said that the internet and e-commerce is what was killing retail or hurting retail currently, don't necessarily think that's the case. This is sort of could be the last battlefield if the border adjustment tax goes in. You know, like I said, no industry would probably be affected as much as retail just because of the goods that are sold and moved in the United States. We tend to import a lot of things, but those are the things that people want. You know, they want those items coming in. They want to pay less prices for them. But it would be a death knell to the retail industry, which is your largest private employer, for instance, in North Carolina with 1 out of 4 jobs.
You mentioned something also important to keep in mind is that consumers want these lower prices. This is not only an impact on the retail merchants, which
Right.
people like to help their retail merchants, but it's an impact on them themselves and all their neighbors and the stuff that they buy, isn't it?
Right. Again, it's essentially, you know, a $1,700 additional tax on consumers of the United States for the average family. So you're raising prices on most goods by about 20%, especially, like I said, a number of goods. You reference clothing or component parts, gasoline, things that you use every single day. Things that, as I said, the cup of coffee you had this morning certainly goes up by about 20%.
If people are hearing us now and they're hearing arguments on the other side about what a great thing the border adjustment tax is, what would you recommend for them to turn to find good information about what this tax would actually do?
Well, there's a lot of good information out there on both sides of the equation. You know, there's a group called Americans for Affordable Products that we are involved with, a coalition which is made up of a number of companies and retailers and other groups throughout the United States that are trying to put out good information. A lot of the economists and others that have come out have said, you know, this sounds good theoretically, but it is really bad, especially, again, in the global economy that we're in. The other thing that you could have happen should this go into place, and there's questions over whether it's even legal or constitutional, but you could be violating international law. You could see repercussions from other countries that put a similar VAT tax, border adjustment tax on their own products, and then you're hurting yourself trying to export things out to other countries.
Well, it's certainly a very hot topic, an interesting one, and we know that one person who's going to be watching very closely as this moves forward or not in Congress is Andy Ellen. He is the president and general counsel of the North Carolina Retail Merchants Association. Andy, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me today.
And we'll have more on Carolina Journal Radio in just a moment.
Are you looking to make North Carolina more free? The John Locke Foundation is, and here are three things you can do today to help us make it happen. First, know the facts. Visit johnlocke.org for data, analysis, interviews, and more. And read carolinajournal.com to learn what government is doing with your money. Second, influence the debate. Invest in the John Locke Foundation's work with a tax-deductible donation. You can get it done in less than 90 seconds at johnlocke.org. And third, make North Carolina more free by sharing the message of freedom. It's easy when you visit johnlocke.org. Click on shareables, download, pass the messages of freedom to your friends, print the messages and mail them. Or if you're a savvy computer user, share the message of freedom on Facebook and Twitter. Know the facts, influence the debate, and share the message. Three things you can do today to help us make North Carolina more free. Get started today at johnlocke.org.
North Carolina is changing, not just day to day, but hour to hour, minute to minute, even second to second. How can you keep up with the changes, especially the ones that affect you, your family, your home, your job? Make the John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal part of your social media diet. On Facebook, like the John Locke Foundation, like Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal. News, insights, and analysis you'll find nowhere else. Thanks to the experts at the John Locke Foundation, and thanks to the first-class investigative reporting of Carolina Journal. Don't wait for the morning newspaper. Don't wait for the evening news. If it's happening now, it's happening here. The John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal have you covered with up-to-the-second information. Like us on Facebook, the John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal.
Did you know you can now advance freedom and free markets just by shopping with Amazon? It's true. Online shopping is now a great way to support the John Locke Foundation. Just shop using the Amazon Smile program and designate us, the Locke Foundation, to receive a portion of your purchase amount. That's right. You shop and Amazon donates money to us, the John Locke Foundation. So here's how it works. Log on to smile.amazon.com. Amazon Smile, it's the same Amazon you know. Same products, same prices. But here's what's better. Amazon donates 0.5% of the price of your eligible purchases to us, the John Locke Foundation. So try it. Be sure to designate the Locke Foundation as the nonprofit you want to support. It's that easy. So now, not only will you enjoy what you buy, you'll also support freedom. Don't forget, log on to smile.amazon.com today, buy something nice, and help defend freedom. Help support the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. A sad story out of Moore County prompted some high-profile legislation this year in the North Carolina General Assembly. Republican State Senator Tamara Berenger explains.
In December of 2015, Rylan Ott was a 19-month-old toddler from Moore County who was returned to his parents without a CPS caseworker ever observing his mother with her children. Despite numerous red flags, objections from the foster parents, objections from the guardian ad litem, the toddler was placed back with his parent without a caseworker ever observing the child with that parent. Tragically, a few months later, Rylan wandered away from home and drowned in a pond.
Berenger says the story of Rylan Ott is not unique.
Sadly, this is not the only time this occurs. This has occurred countless times over the last 10 years in North Carolina, and we have an opportunity as Republicans, as Democrats, and as unaffiliated people to do something about it.
That's why lawmakers pushed Rylan's Law. It won bipartisan support, including Democratic Senator Gladys Robinson.
All of our hearts drop when we see that a child is injured or dies especially if there is something that could have been done to prevent it.
The Senate combined Ryland's law with a study of North Carolina's child welfare services. Beringer has been pushing the issue. Democrat Floyd McKissick offered a word of caution.
The thing which I've asked her to do, and I tend to work with her on, is try to make sure that we don't throw the baby out with the bathwater. And when I say that, there are best practices used today within our 100 counties. There are some counties that do an exceptional job in delivering social services. There are other counties that do not. I think the important thing to do is to look at best practices and to find out what best practices are out there that can be emulated in all 100 counties.
Beringer responded to McKissick. She says the study does not have any predetermined goal.
There's no foregone conclusion. This does give me an opportunity to argue vigorously for a good data system. Without the data that you so mentioned, Senator McKissick, all we are doing is simply shuffling cards on a deck. It will not help the children or families of this state. We have to have data that we can read, that we can apply to these various situations so that there can be proper training, there can be management and measurement of the outcomes. And so there is in this bill, though, the opportunity for counties for the first time to collaborate across county lines. Children deserve a family, not a system. And so what we need is not a system that's regionalized, but we need families for all of our children. And to have those children, those families have to be healthy.
You've been listening to Debate About Legislation Designed to Improve Government Services for Children in North Carolina. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
Are you tired of fake news? Well, you won't find it here. At Carolina Journal, we don't make things up and we don't presume or assign motives. There's no simpler way to put it than that. We're proud to say that honest, factual, rigorous journalism is the Carolina Journal way. Our reporting team is focused on accountability in government and policymaking, no matter which political party is in power and regardless of the person taken to task in the story. At Carolina Journal, we're beholden to the truth and to transparency. Unlike fake news, lies, innuendo, questionable sourcing, all meant to create controversy, not inform the debate. So the next time you're confronted with fake news, log on to CarolinaJournal.com or pick up the latest print edition. You'll find compelling news reporting from a team that knows what it means to be real journalists, committed to truth. Carolina Journal, you can count on us for the facts.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. Does America have a so-called grand strategy in the age of Trump? Should it have such a strategy? A recent panel discussion hosted by the John William Pope Foundation and Jesse Helms Center tackled that topic. One featured speaker was Dr. Henry Now, a former National Security Council senior staffer and current political science professor at George Washington University. Before addressing Trump, Now reminded the audience how a grand strategy helped his former boss, Ronald Reagan.
By the late 1970s, we were in trouble, big trouble, economic trouble. Soviet Union was on the advance in the world. Oil prices were skyrocketing. And Ronald Reagan confronted a very, very difficult set of circumstances. He didn't say, well, I'm going to react to those circumstances and we'll take care of this little problem and that little problem. No, he had a strategy for how he wanted to proceed. And the first thing he wanted to do, of course, was to rebuild America's military and economic might, all right, for the purpose not of trying to defeat the Soviet Union in some kind of a nuclear war. He didn't mind if they worried a little bit about that. But his objective was eventually to negotiate with the Soviet Union. But to do it, of course, from a position of strength where the Soviets realized that they wouldn't be able to keep up with him unless they sat out on the table and talked with him and eventually led to the agreements, in many cases, that unraveled the Soviet Union and led to the end of the Cold War.
Now then turned to President Trump.
I want to argue that, look, he has a fundamentally nationalist view, all right, of America's role in the world. Coupled with a few realist elements in terms of his desire to work with some of the great powers, Russia and China, but that he has very little so far. He's given us very little by way of telling us how he would like to shape the world, how he would like to move the world forward. Very few are what we call the internationalist elements.
Now started with Trump's nationalist tendencies.
Nationalists generally accept the world as it is. They don't see any great opportunities to change it. They define national security rather narrowly in terms of defending America's territory, borders, and immediate sea lanes. They see no need to help others defend themselves because they have a greater motivation to defend themselves than we do. So they'll take care of themselves. Generally expects the world to kind of take care of itself. But if that world does mess with us, if that world does intervene in some way, we're going to strike back at them very, very hard. No doubt about the fact that Trump puts America first.
But Al says President Trump is not a nationalist alone.
Now, the realist elements in Trump's thinking are also evident, I think, but they're maybe a little fuzzier. And what do I mean by realist elements? Well, I mean those elements where we think we have to engage the world more broadly to try to balance power around the world, not just on our borders, but in Europe, in Asia, and in the Middle East. You can think here of Henry Kissinger and world order. Well, what are those elements in Trump's thinking? Well, first of all, NATO. Now, he did say during the campaign that NATO was obsolete, but even before the election, he said, no, I've changed my mind because you know what? NATO is beginning to pay more attention to terrorism. They just deployed a division, four brigades of troops in the Baltic states and in Poland, and they're getting the message. So in his inaugural address, he said, we're going to reinforce NATO. He didn't say dismantle. We're going to reinforce NATO. So I think there's a element that suggests that he understands that we've got to be engaged in the balance of power and we've got good allies. All right? He's going to demand more from them. There's no question about that.
That's George Washington University political scientist Henry Now, a former National Security Council senior staffer under Ronald Reagan. He's discussing President Trump's approach to a grand strategy, focusing first on Trump's nationalist and realist tendencies.
It's the internationalist elements, though, that are missing in Trump's approach up to this point. He doesn't like to think too much, like my boss did, Ronald Reagan, about the importance of defending and spreading democracy in the world. The internationalist is looking for ways to shape the world, change it, not just accept it and react to it, like the nationalist and the realist, but rather to kind of make it a little better place. Now, we go about this in two ways generally. One is by strengthening international institutions. That's sort of the liberal alternative. But there's another way to do that, and that is by using military leverage in negotiations, as Ronald Reagan did, in order to advance the cause of freedom.
So what does Now think of where the president stands?
I like his nationalism with a bit of realism, and I'm not overly disturbed by the lack of the internationalist elements up till this point. I think we needed that, all right, after the kind of very internationalist, very liberal internationalist approach of Obama. But I don't know if nationalism and realism are enough. I think we really have to worry about the way the world is drifting politically. And what do I mean by that? Well, if we retreat, as the nationalists would argue, or, you know, pare down our role in the world, or if we simply accommodate events like Crimea, Russia's intervention in Crimea, in order to get along with other great powers, the world is going to drift against us. Authoritarianism is going to gain. It's gaining now. It's been gaining ever since 2006.
Now says the United States can't ignore international challenges.
Our defense depends not just on protecting our territory and our borders and our allies. It also depends upon the kind of world in which we are defending ourselves. A world of more democracies is automatically a safer world for America than a world in which the authoritarian powers are gaining.
How can Trump approach international relations in a way that makes sense?
It's not easy to do this. It costs something to do this. And this is where we have to really respect, I think, the American people, and I'm probably over my time already, but this is where we have to respect their schizophrenia, it was said earlier, or their caution about being involved in too many places too deeply around the world and sending our troops off for 10 or 15 years into places like Afghanistan and Iraq and earlier Vietnam. Now, I'm going to propose something very simple here, which will cause a lot of headaches, I suspect, for military planners and others, but it's one way of trying to make the costs of an American leadership role in defending and expanding freedom around the world, make those costs more acceptable, bring them down. And what I would argue is we need to set some priorities. We need to worry about the conflicts in the international arena that really matter for freedom. If we lose freedom, for example, or the prospect for freedom in Ukraine, let alone in Poland or Hungary or in the Baltic states, we've lost a lot. We've lost a lot more than if we lose democracy, which has never really existed in any significant form, in Iraq or Afghanistan or earlier Vietnam. So we should keep our eye on the ball. And the ball is on the border, what I call the major frontiers of freedom, between Russia and the European states, who are now free and democratic, and the frontier between China and the democratic allies of America in Asia.
Now would downsize the efforts to build up democracies in parts of the world that haven't had them in the past.
Put in another government a little bit better. Stay over the horizon in case the situation deteriorates again and you have to go in. I mean, look, if they start training terrorists and we see that they're about to attack Europe or what have you, you go in, put in 30, 40, 50,000 forces if you need to take care of it, but then come back. Then come back and let the local forces work with it. It's not going to be perfect. It's going to be messy. A lot of these groups can't get along, for example, in Afghanistan and Iraq. But we can do this a little bit, I think, with a little bit less cost than we have in the past. Still dealing with threat, but making sure, above all, that we don't get diverted. We don't get diverted from the central battles. And by the way, in the last 10 years, that's happened to some extent.
Now labels his approach conservative internationalism. It was one perspective put forward during a recent panel discussion in Raleigh on American grand strategy. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
If you love freedom, we've got great news to share with you. Now you can find the latest news, views, and research from conservative groups all across the state, all in one place. NorthCarolinaConservative.com, one-stop shopping for North Carolina's freedom movement. At NorthCarolinaConservative.com, you'll find links to John Locke Foundation blogs on the day's news, CarolinaJournal.com reporting and quick takes, Carolina Journal radio interviews, TV interviews featuring CJ reporters and Locke Foundation analysts, plus opinion pieces and reports on higher education, all of that from the Pope Center for Higher Education Policy, commentary and polling data from the Civitas Institute, and news and views from the North Carolina Family Policy Council. That's right, all of that, all in one place. NorthCarolinaConservative.com. That's North Carolina, spelled out, conservative.com. NorthCarolinaConservative.com. Log on today. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Donna Martinez. North Carolina's new $23 billion operating budget continues the fiscally conservative approach of the Republicans who control the General Assembly. Restrained spending, more savings, more tax reform to ensure that North Carolinians keep more of what they earn. But some critics are now saying that this path could actually lead to long-term fiscal problems. Are they wrong or are they right? Joe Coletti is a senior fellow with the John Locke Foundation. He is a budget expert. He's been looking at the numbers. Joe, welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me.
First, set the stage for us. Talk a little bit more about the trend of the past several years.
Fortunately, the trend over the past few years, especially since 2011, as we started to recover from the recession and lost the federal stimulus money, has been some fiscal restraint from the General Assembly. Spending has been growing at a slower rate than population and inflation. And so haven't been cutting spending, but they've been growing it slower than it had been growing. And while doing that, they've been able to, as you said in the introduction, been able to cut taxes and been able to set more money aside in savings so that when the next downturn hits, we'll be in better shape because we've been spending less, spending within our means, and that we've been saving some. And so the next time that something happens, we'll be in good shape. And that leaves, like you said, more opportunity for us to be able to keep more of our own money.
So the legislature has indeed been increasing spending, but they have been paring back how much that it had traditionally increased in previous years.
Yeah, it had been growing through the 2000s. faster than population and inflation growth and faster than revenues could keep up with it. That's why we kept having temporary tax increases and why they kept dipping into one-time funds. We haven't had to do that in the last few years.
Fair to say that we're on more sound financial ground right now?
Yeah, we are definitely on a much more sustainable path with the budget than we had been, and the Mercatus Center recognizes that and ranked us 15th, and that's based on 2015 numbers, and so we should continue to improve on that ranking.
What then has generated some media coverage and some questions by some that somehow or another the fiscal restraint in terms of budgeting is going to lead us down the wrong path?
Well, even with slower spending as we've had, if you take a look at what we currently spend and how we currently spend, when you take those and extend them out 5 years, which is what the Fiscal Research Division at the General Assembly, kind of like the Congressional Budget Office at the state level, they were asked to do that by Senate Democrats. And when you do that, you assume that we're doing all the right things, all the right ways, at the right prices, for the right people, at the right time. And that's just probably not true. And so the only thing that changes in those assumptions is that we cover more people at higher prices. That's where, and so when you start making those assumptions, that can lead you into difficult problems. And spending is actually what drives the projected deficits, projected spending gaps that are seen in 5 years, more so than anything else. And so that's the starting point. We start in a budget gap because economic growth is slow and we've got this relatively high spending growth.
So do you think that this report then and the media coverage of it has been accurate? Are we headed down a wrong path?
Well, no. Well, the report is accurate. What fiscal research was looking at and the way that they looked at it was accurate. They start from some assumptions that are helpful in raising questions about what should we do and how should we be spending money. But the coverage of it misses those other points of what's driving the spending growth, what's baked into the assumptions of this. And so that's led to a lot of coverage that blames the tax reform for the budget gap, when really it's spending growth based on some questionable assumptions. And even folks who are in support of higher taxes, because that's what the general refrain is, let's have higher taxes. Even people who are in support of higher taxes, when they look at the budget, there are things that they see that they would want to have reduced spending on. So that's where we start.
What is the biggest wrong assumption, I guess I will call it, that is in this report?
That we are doing the right thing, all the right things, all the right ways for the right people. What the legislature has been able to do in the past few years is take a look at where we are spending money, do some analysis of that, and say we shouldn't have this program, or there are ways to make these things more efficient. We have improving technology, we have improving processes. So even without changing the services that are delivered, how you deliver them can affect. What it costs. And so they focused on how much are we spending and how do we live within our means instead of what are we doing and how do we continue doing the exact same thing.
So, Joe, you have some recommendations because you have acknowledged in your writing that we have been doing some fiscally restrained things over the past several years, but you're always thinking, gosh, we need to continue this, and a little bit concerned that maybe somewhere along the line some legislators might say, no, let's kind of ramp up that spending and do things differently. What are your recommendations to make sure that we are continuing to be on sound fiscal ground?
Well, my recommendations are generally on the spending side, because that's the first place that you can run into trouble. As I said, that's mm-hmm. where the $200 million, that's where the shortfall starts, is on the spending side. So looking at ways to be more efficient, ways to improve programs, ways to eliminate programs, that's always a place to begin. So some of the things that we took a look at that they did this year, that the legislature did this year, was providing earmarks to a number of organizations, both for-profit and non-profit. And some of those are for competitive grants, so things that normally should be open to anybody. And so making those actually competitive and basing funding on what the results are is a good place to start with a number of programs, and then taking a look throughout the rest of the budget about what should we be doing. So those are a couple places that I have. And some of that will require some more spending, actually, in the near term to make sure that we have the financial systems and the management systems to be able to answer those questions.
Ultimately, Joe, it kind of sounds like what you're saying is that you can't take anything for granted, and that in order to make sure that you're keeping things in line and don't go off on the wrong path, you've got to just watch that budget by like a hawk, essentially.
Yeah. Phrase that I used earlier in something that I just wrote is question-based budgeting, that all of these things should raise questions. They shouldn't be taken as final answers, whether it's a budget projection or anything else. We should, anytime that we see something, it should raise more questions about what we're doing and how we're doing it. And if we do that, then we can get to good answers about what we should be spending.
Because sometimes the approach is, well, if we happen to be funding a particular service or program in 2017, the assumption goes forward that in 2020 or 2022, yeah, we're going to be funding that program and more people are going to be, quote, needing that program.
Right. Sometimes if we do things right and if the economy grows, then we have fewer needs for some social services, and we can always change how we do things. So hopefully some people don't need as many things, and we can find other ways to accomplish our same goals.
Joe, one of the things that you have done recently with this new general fund operating budget is you have broken it down into some major categories of spending with some really great graphics and explanation. Gives people a really good sense of what we're spending the money on in North Carolina. And of course, we all pay taxes. If you're working, you pay taxes. And so it's a great, very easy to understand guide. And you can find that at johnlock.org. We've been talking with Joe Coletti. Joe, thank you very much.
Thank you, Donna.
That's all the time we have for Carolina Journal Radio this week. Thank you for listening. On behalf of Mitch Kokai, I'm Donna Martinez. We hope you'll join us again next week for more Carolina Journal Radio.
Carolina Journal Radio is a program of the John Locke Foundation. To learn more about the John Locke Foundation, including donations that support programs like Carolina Journal Radio, send email to development@johnlocke.org or call 1-866-JLF-INFO. That's 1-866-553-4636.
Carolina Journal Radio is a co-production of the John Locke Foundation, North Carolina's free market think tank, and Carolina Broadcasting System, Incorporated. All opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of advertisers or the station. For more information about the show or other programs and services of the John Locke Foundation, visit johnlocke.org or call us toll-free at 866-JLF-INFO. We'd like to thank our wonderful radio affiliates across North Carolina and our sponsors. From all of us at Carolina Journal Radio, thank you for listening, and please join us again next week.